Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Jeffrey McElwain, an expert on disaster response and humanitarian assistance. Jeffrey teaches an Introduction to Emergency Management course at San Diego State's College of Extended Studies, where he instructs students how to be a survivor and not, as he puts it, zombie chum. He is also a co-founder and former co-director of the Graduate Program in Homeland Security at SDSU and former director of the International Security and Conflict Resolution Program there, as well as coordinator of a graduate program in criminal justice and criminology. In addition, he's a fellow and adjunct faculty member in the Operational Studies Department at Joint Special Operations University, which is the War College for U.S. Special Operations Command. In addition, he's an expert on the Islamic State for the 1st Marine Expeditional Force. And he's also an author. His most recent book, Deconstructing Organized Crime, was nominated for Outstanding Book Award by the American Society of Criminology. And he's studied mass human migrations, including those after World War I and World War II. So he is a true expert on many of the very issues that are in our headlines today. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be able to come and talk to East County.
Let's start by having you tell us how you first got interested in disasters, disaster response, and risk management. What were the formative events in your life that had an impact?
And at an early age, I grew up with a family that was very civically minded and did a lot of volunteer work through Optimus and Rotary and other service clubs. And my dad used to handle safety at Southern California Gas, for example. So it was something that was kind of bred into me. But what really happened, what was the key event, was in 1986. There was a mid-air collision in Los Angeles, and a 737 crashed into my home. Mm-hmm. And regrettably, my mother was killed, and as well as a number of my neighbors. And that happened before my senior year in high school. Yeah. That day, I volunteered with the Red Cross for the first time, and then over the years, had a number of years I dedicated towards serving the Red Cross as a volunteer and eventually as a board member, and then also had worked in a civilian capacity for Los Angeles County Office of Emergency Management. And so, yeah, so it's been a long haul of work in that area.
Wow, so that's quite a challenging journey that you've been on to get where you are today. Mm-hmm. With your background in Homeland Security and Special Operations, as well as the study of mass human migrations after World War I and World War II, can you tell us what your thoughts are about the current threat posed by ISIS? And could San Diego be a target? Is that a risk that we should be concerned about here?
It's a risk that we have to be reasonably concerned about. I mean, it's the stated intention of our adversaries. It's also one that they've shown the capability of being able to enact all across the world, not just within areas that they control. Just today, you can read one of the British newspapers, you know, talked about 77 people so far who've been arrested in the United States dealing for different reasons, but all related going back to ISIS, Islamic State, with the head of the FBI has talked about the ongoing investigations within all 50 states and I think even territories in this country as well. And of course, being proximate to a major international border does offer its own unique challenges as well. So I do think that it's something that we need to be prudent on. We have professionals who are out there that are literally working day and night to prevent this from happening, hopefully before it ever comes to our shores. But if here to find it out and deal with it before it leads to the violence we saw in Paris.
Yeah. We've certainly seen in recent years a rise in anti-immigrant sentiments, but particularly after the Paris attacks. We have seen growing concern about the president's plan to admit 10,000 Syrian refugees to the United States, as the United Nations has asked, and about 300 of those could wind up right here in San Diego. How confident are you in the vetting process being done to weed out potential terrorists? And what do you believe our approach should be to addressing the massive humanitarian crisis faced by the Syrian refugees, who themselves, most of them, of course, are fleeing ISIS?
Yeah, and it's important to keep that in mind, is that at least those coming from Syria and Iraq have been faced with tremendous adversity, and we need to continue to emphasize the best, I think, that we bring as a country, as well as our friends in Europe and other places, that we do need to welcome those that are in need of shelter, as do other countries, for example, in the Muslim world, who need to be doing the same thing, countries like Jordan who've done incredible things. I mean, so we need to keep our eye on what makes us very strong as a country and what's our best side. That said, there is also a legitimate concern that the eagerness to emphasize that best side of our character and our values can also create security vulnerabilities. And I believe that there's some very strong truth to that. I just mentioned earlier about the 77 who've been arrested, some of whom, of course, came in as refugees from other places.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that every refugee is going to meet that same profile. As a matter of fact, in the refugee communities that I work very closely with, these are folks that suffered the oppression of the very people that we're talking about, and the fear that they have is from the same groups. And they've proved to be one of our greatest assets in terms of being able to look for the outsiders who are coming in to recruit, who are looking for people to join them in their particular cause. And these are people that are eager to assist not just our efforts here in the United States, but also overseas in places like France and Germany. And
yeah, you've mentioned you've had some of your own students come to you with tips about people who seem to be recruiting for nefarious causes over here.
Well, Al-Awlaki back in this is the American that was droned in Yemen a while back, who ran Inspire magazine, a lot of the propaganda. He was actively working in the San Diego area when I came to San Diego. And my students who are Muslim, who knew of my interest and background, and they were telling me that this guy is somebody that you need to keep an eye on. And it was funny, years later I found they had brought all this material he had handed out, and I had it in a file, and I completely forgot I had this. And I had it in a file. So when I was moving my office, I found this old file from pre-2001, that these students brought me this material. And there's people that are like that. I think when it comes to the broader immigration issues, I think that one thing we need to keep in mind, I think we've put ourselves into a position where the rhetoric on either side of this has kind of thrown some common sense out of the window. I think that on the one side, once again, we are a stronger nation by bringing those, like in my own family's history, who have been refugees of wars and other places, to come to this nation's shores to take advantage for all the things that we value. At the same point, I also think it's reasonable for people to ask that the processes that are in place are set up in such a way that we can be pretty much as sure as we possibly can that those that come do not bring harm if they have criminal backgrounds, associations, or other issues.
Do we have a strong enough vetting process, or are there things that should be done that aren't? How confident are you that it's fairly effective at weeding out potential terrorists?
I think that even the most effective vetting process will still have error to it, because at the end of the day, human beings implement any processes there, and human beings are inherently fallible. I think that, however, we need to be focused on the fact that are the current laws, the administrative policies and procedures that people are using at the ports of entry, are these things being universally applied? Mm-hmm. Are these procedures being followed correctly? Or are people being forced to maybe expedite certain processes for some groups versus others? I think that there needs to be some uniformity. And I'm a big time believer in rule of law and due process, and that good things happen when we do that. How it's playing out, you know, we're going to have to end up seeing. You can hear different voices on this arguing either side of it. But the proof is in the pudding, where we do find, for example, in the Paris attacks and other attacks, where there are elements that will take advantage of the situation for strategic objective. And it is the declared objective by ISIS as well in their strategic documents. In Black Flags Over Rome and some of their other publications they have, they talk about taking advantage of the movement of people to infiltrate and be able to engage in such attacks.
Yeah, it's really chilling, because as you say, on the one hand, we want to be humanitarian, we want to help these people that are in need, but how do you do that without putting yourself at risk also? On the other hand, while there's been a lot of focus on the refugees and the chance that there could be, you know, the occasional one among them who's up to no good, there's also a lot of radicalization that's occurred of American citizens who weren't refugees or immigrants. Should we be more concerned about that, perhaps? You know, which is the greater danger here?
Well, I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. And I believe, and I know, that our authorities that are involved with trying to prevent these sort of things from happening are equally looking at those two different avenues. When considering the sophistication with which ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other types of groups recruit, they take advantage of individuals that are concerned with similar issues. It might be global injustice. It might be refugee issues. It might be Palestine, whatever. They basically take advantage of the fact that people are already inclined to hear a message that they have to offer. They might hit, and they have hit, aggressively prisons, for example, throughout Europe and also in the United States for the recruitment of individuals, but also on college campuses where sometimes people's ideologies might put up some blinders in terms of how they might be being manipulated to go in certain directions. We see this time and time again, for example, with the young women that are being recruited out of places in Europe and universities and other areas, but as well as the young men who are going to view what they view as a positive change in their life. So, you know, these are sophisticated techniques, and they're things that bear prudent observation.
We have been at war in Iraq now for over a decade, and yet the terrorism today has spread far beyond just Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's far from being contained. How do you put the genie back in the bottle? What more could the U.S. and other countries be doing to stop terrorism, and is there a solution beyond a military one that deserves more attention? And also, what do you feel about the military intervention?
Well, I mean, this is the deal. I mean, in their own words, both Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is now ISIS, had massive amounts of reflection of how they lost in the Iraq war coming about 2008, 2009. And they were literally on the ropes. If you want to put a picture to it, imagine, you know, a boot on the neck with a coup de grace about to be applied. And we left. We left a vacuum. The Sunni tribes in the areas of Iraq where these folks had previously operated, they were left really with no friends to back them up in their efforts to deal with this. And as they had the government itself being going back to persecuting them or to politically disempowering them, to say it in other ways. But also they didn't have the ability to fully keep Al-Qaeda in Iraq from resurfacing. So in many ways, it was a huge blunder, all for the notion that, well, we wanted to bring people home. Well, for my veterans who spilled their blood, my veteran friends who've spilled their blood and in some cases lost their lives, it matters when you actually make a change in the long term. It's very difficult when you go and sacrifice only to have those sacrifices made, in a sense, a chit in a game of political expediency, the result of which we've seen this group has just metastasized. We needed to have been there. You clear, you hold, but then the next part is you build. And you do so through a broad range of coalition of partners in that country, as well as outside partners to make it happen. It's not done on the cheap. It's not done in the short term. And it takes strong political commitment, something that politically our country decided they did not want to bear.
Yeah, it's almost a catch-22, because on the one hand, the sort of proactive invasion of Iraq under President Bush, you know, when you go in and you start bombing cities, then it fuels resentment and suddenly everybody becomes a freedom fighter and they're off joining these terrorist groups and hating the United States. And on the other hand, when you don't do anything, there's still, the terrorism that is fomented. And as you've noted, if you pull out too soon, then it spreads and is not contained. If you were the president today and you could wave your magic wand, what would your approach be from a military standpoint and from, other aspects? What is the proper way to contain or reduce the risk of ISIS?
Well, I mean, frankly, I'd stop leading from behind and lead from the front. We see now in the Muslim world, the Arab world, and the European world, that people are willing to do things, that people are willing to step up to create the broad sort of coalition necessary to deal with the enemy that really has no other friends. I mean, you think about it. Mm-hmm. Our adversaries, strategic competitors, as you might call it, like Russia and others, we're all on the same page here.
Well, yeah, they just shot down a Russian jetliner. The Russians now said that that was a bomb. Mm-hmm. ISIS has claimed credit for that and then the massacre in terrorists. So, in a sense, they're almost doing the job for us of trying to build this coalition of people who would have been reluctant to be too involved before.
Yeah. And so, I mean, so the idea here is that we basically need leadership to get folks together to actually make the commitment to physically remove these individuals from these areas.
So you're talking boots on the ground.
Absolutely. You can't bomb people day in and day out and expect it to go away. And not only that, we are completely chasing a rabbit if we think ISIS is only contained to this particular area.
It's like whack-a-mole, in terms of Syria and Iraq. And it's all over the world.
Large portions of North Africa, West Africa, Central Africa, the Horn of Africa, large portion of the Pakistani Taliban operating both within Pakistan and Afghanistan, in Central Asia, in Southeast Asia, have all dedicated themselves and changed their allegiance from Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State. They have emirates now that struts along the southern coast of the Mediterranean that can now endanger shipping lines, that have the ability through the weapons that were seized from Gaddafi and his army to be able to strike southern Europe. We have a major issue on our hands that is in multiple areas of operation and necessitate a systematic campaign, not just to prevent them from doing, continuing to do the outrageous acts they're doing to the populations that they control, to completely destroy our human history, they've done in Timbuktu and places in Syria. I mean, all these terrible things we sit and bemoan, but it's also to keep other areas from falling under that knife, falling under that, the hammers that they're using to break churches, cathedrals, museums, etc. And not only that, it's also to prevent that concept of inevitability that they thrive on.
Yeah.
God is on their side with no, as far as they're concerned.
And yet they're killing other Muslims as well now. The Paris
absolutely.
Attacks certainly. And you know, you've talked about in the lobby earlier how the ISIS would march into these towns, and if there were Muslims there who wouldn't adopt the specific ISIS brand of, you know, Islam or terrorism, that they would behead them or sell them into slavery, just as has been done with the Yazidis and the Christians and other people in that part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are frankly outside of Islam. They don't adhere to any of the eight large madhabs, the schools of Islamic jurisprudence. These guys are viewed as a death cult within the context, even within the branches that stem from one of those mahabs, they're viewed as a death cult. These guys believe in the concept of abrogation.
Mm-hmm.
They will take whole verses and whole sayings in the hadith, in the sunnah, in the Quran, and because they find them politically or ideologically or religiously not expedient to their objectives, they'll declare them nasch. That means they'll completely move these things out.
Terrible.
And say that they're going to emphasize other aspects in order to achieve their objectives. These guys are at war with Islam. They're at war with those outside of Islam. And they're waging that war in the traditional areas referred to as Dar al-Islam, the area that has been historical Muslim lands, as well as in Dar al-Harb, which is the world of wars, as referred to, those areas that are outside of traditional Muslim lands as well.
Yeah, such as Europe. On the other side of the coin, we're seeing a rise in nativism and racism and sort of this fear of immigrants, you know, that's being fueled in part by what ISIS is doing. And you talked a little bit earlier about what's happening in Europe and how it's important to understand some of the fear that's behind that. You told a story about what's happening in some of these small towns in Europe and how if we don't understand that point of view, things can only get worse.
Yeah. When looking at the increased polarization of the discussions in Europe on this issue, I am heartbroken of, in a sense, the tone deafness of many of those that are in the political leadership in Europe, who will dismiss those who have legitimate concerns about changes that are happening in communities that I think people are willing to ask. When you have small towns, for example, of 100 people and you're bringing in 1,000 refugees to an area, okay, well, how do we maintain policing when we don't have police officers?
Yeah.
We don't have grocery stores. How do we provide? These are simple common sense questions, and I've seen tape after tape where people who are asking these, who are willing to work and get along, who are immediately called racist or called xenophobes and completely shut down for what I think is a very normal, reasonable action.
Yeah, so we need to separate out that from the people who really are just hate mongers.
Yeah, and the thing is that by abandoning the concerns of people, and you got to realize, for most people go to Europe, they'll go to Paris, or they'll go to Stockholm, or they'll go to London, true metropolitan cities. But when you go to Europe, when you go to the small towns and villages, Europe is very tribal. It has been for centuries. And it has experienced war for centuries, where outsiders have come in, They've stolen the goods. They've taken the men. There's been raping. There's been pillaging. And you can go into the churches and you can go into the courtyards and see monuments to all the terrible things these communities have suffered. As an American, I can go in there and people immediately want to know, who am I? What am I doing there? This and that. Because there's a legitimate, historically based reason people look to the outside when they're trying to take care of their own.
So there's a pendulum swing, sort of. It seems to me it's one of those things, if you go too far in either extreme, you can certainly have problems. And we're seeing it even in this country. On the one hand, we have Donald Trump and a number of governors saying, let's not let in a single Syrian refugee, to use just one example. And on the other hand, you know, I opened my mailbox today. There's probably 20 emails in there from petition after petition from one group or another saying either let's, you know, tell the president, let's not let any of these refugees in. And another saying we have to be humanitarian. Let's let them all in, pretty much. Is there a middle ground here someplace?
This is what I mean.
Stay reasonably safe and yet still be humanitarian.
Yeah. And I think I do believe that people honestly want to help people in need. I believe people honestly want to provide refuge for folks that are in need. But I also think people have substantive concerns of what does that do to an economy, to jobs, to things like that. The problem is, in the polemics in terms of our politics, it's either you're completely against or completely for.
Right.
And the people who yell the loudest are not keeping people, reasonable people, from sitting in a room and figuring, hey, how can we emphasize the best of our nature while at the same time keeping in mind of things like security, economy, our cultural integrity. I mean, you got to remember, here you have these small towns in Switzerland or Austria or other places. Mm-hmm. They have a strong, vibrant culture that's been around for hundreds of years.
Sure.
They're proud of it. It's not that they're xenophobic or they're nationalistic. It's just they're proud of it.
Yeah.
And so the question is, okay, they fear this change. That fear is coming from a certain place. And anybody who'd say you want to break down fear needs to say you have to look at the honest intentions of those that are talking about that. Failing to do so, once again, provides credence to those that bring up the worst of nationalist tendencies in the history of Europe.
Yeah.
And which is what we see.
We're certainly seeing that bleed over and having an impact on the Iraqi Chaldeans who are seeking to come here. We have something like 40,000 of them here in East County, but now what's happened is the door is being shut. The new asylees that are coming over, even if they have family here who are willing to vouch for them, take them in, they're being imprisoned down there at Otay for 6 months or a year, and then for the most part sent back. I mean, is that an example maybe of the pendulum going too far the other way? How do we
compassion? I mean, honestly, I'm not in a position to comment on that because I don't know the specifics of what the policy is. And anecdotally, I hear things going different ways. And it's difficult for me to make an assessment of that not knowing the facts. I think it would be unfair of me to really weigh in on that.
Let's talk a little bit about how the terrorists, ISIS in particular, is recruiting people and how that's changed in the era of the internet. What can you tell us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. There was a study done a few years back that looked at – they were studying people who had been arrested for basically taking pedophilia-type images off the internet. And one of the things that they were looking at was how people that normally would never have gone in that route followed a click trail, right? Mm-hmm. A breadcrumb trail on the internet. You start clicking one room. You go to one chat room. You go here. And the next thing you know, they're going into areas – of what they would normally have considered sexually deviant behavior and harmful behavior, they're now looking at pictures of teenage girls or boys or something else along those lines. And one of the interesting things that came away with that is when we look at terrorist recruitment, in many some ways it can work the same way. I don't think people like Adam Gadon or others, you know, the American Taliban, you know, they were interested in certain causes. And as a result of that interest in certain causes would, you know, like you said, get something in the inbox one day or something.
Yeah. It's like your shopping preferences. You go click on a shopping site to look at a red hat. Next thing you know, you got all these hat ads for every kind of hat in the world popping up, inviting you to go join the hat club or something.
Yeah. And then you're asked to go to a meeting. And then, you know, the reality is people recruit out of these things. People are looking for folks like this. And, you know, we want to think, okay, everything's great and harmless and this and that because we can all care about something that's close to our heart. But there's a certain profile of folks that these guys know to look for, and they go out and they exploit it, and they have. And this is not new. This has been going on for years. And so, you know, we have videotape of the various camps with people from America or from European countries who were born in those countries, native Germans, native Gauls, others who are in these camps who found themselves through their interests, be it politics, ideology, whatever it is, found themselves following a breadcrumb trail that brought them to people, that made them feel wanted, that made them feel accepted, that gave them purpose.
Kind of the same kind of reason people get involved in gangs maybe in this country.
Well, yeah, but also it's the same thing that, once again, from a prison standpoint, when you look at a guy like Zarqawi over in Iraq, who basically was the founder of what we now call ISIS and is revered by ISIS as their lead example, not bin Laden. You know, here's a guy that was a professional criminal. Many of those that started out with his group, which becomes the foundation of ISIS, were professional criminals recruited in prisons. When I was in Spain after the 3/11 bombings, working with my Spanish colleagues, speaking with the judges on this, the act of recruitment occurring in prisons is ridiculous. You see it in London now, for example. You see it in England. You see lines being drawn in the sand in correctional populations. And same thing in this, our own country. You can go to our prison libraries and you can see, well, who's providing the readings in these libraries?
Scary.
What presses? What commentaries are they getting to the Quran or other things? So there's some interesting things.
Yeah. You have told me that when you look at who the recruits actually are, that it's really night and day opposite of what most people would think, that this isn't necessarily some, you know, disadvantaged poor guy out of the slums of the Middle East joining ISIS, at least in this country. Tell us what you found.
The MIT Technology Review recently had a study that talked about Twitter data mining to talk about the origins of support for the Islamic State. And what's interesting, I think a lot of people in their mind have it that it's a disaffected person that, like as their Secretary of State said, it's a psychopath doing this stuff. Nothing can be further from the truth from a concrete research-based assessment. To quote the study specifically, it said, studies of people who have joined these kinds of organizations suggest that they tend to be better educated, financially better off, more exposed to Western culture, and generally more accomplished than average.
Wow.
Neither do these individuals show evidence of psychological disorders. On the contrary, they appear to be more psychologically robust than average.
Wow. And whose study was that?
That was from the MIT Technology Review.
MIT.
But it reflects other studies that have looked at similar issues. I mean, just look at the 9/11 case.
Yeah.
These are individuals that came from solid families who went to university, were studying engineering. That, you know, it wasn't the dregs of society, that people with low IQs or had mental issues. It wasn't along those lines. The thing that we have a difficult time of addressing here in Western society is that we might believe that God is dead. Well, God is not dead for large parts of the world. And when the notion of the caliphate having been restored, that resonates with people. Because if you read Sayyid Qutb, who is one of the founders, you know, the leading writers for the Muslim Brotherhood and related movements, he talked about how when Ataturk took over Turkey with regard to the secularization of Turkey, what he called that was the death of Islam, because a caliphate no longer existed. The idea of setting up a caliphate where you have somebody who is in charge of seeing that God's will on earth is being properly enacted through law, through justice, and that has an appeal to people who might not ever feel fully acculturated to these other belief systems in which they live in the other cultural context.
I mean, it's such a brutal form of Islam with the beheadings, the enslavement, the rape
but,
of children.
But it's only brutal for those that don't agree, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So this is the issue within Islam. And we have to understand once again that as these individuals in Islam are looking at this, talking with my friends, Muslim after Muslim gives the following quote. The Prophet himself gave a prophecy where he talked about when he was asked, did the Prophet say anything about those that are going to be coming from the East? And he says, they will appear from the area of Iraq, some people who will recite the Quran, but it will not go beyond their throats, and they will go out from or leave Islam as an arrow darts through the game's body. So prophetically, for other Muslims looking at this, this is exactly what's being talked about time and time again. And so this resonates.
Very interesting. In the last week or so, Anonymous, the famous hacker group, has come out and said that they have declared war on ISIS, and they're going around taking down ISIS Twitter feeds and, you know, trying to even go after and disrupt some of their banking, apparently, or so they claim. How effective could that be? What do you think about things like that?
I find it really interesting, because what we have here is, and there's two sides of this, and I think both sides make sense. So it's kind of difficult sometimes on a given day, you can believe one side or the other based upon your interest in the situation. The one side would say that you want to keep people chatting above board. You want to be in a position to observe them, to monitor them, to do the data mining that we just talked about in that Twitter feeds and everything else, because that provides a lot of really concrete intelligence and information about your adversary. The other side, of course, is forget about it. Shut them down. Pull the plug. Don't let them do this. Don't let them organize.
Yeah.
But remember the history of any revolutionary movement, of any persecuted ideology or persecuted group. They've never had problems getting the message out before the internet. So the question is, if it goes below ground, it would still be occurring. It's just going to be harder to see. So this argument can go back and forth. I find it hysterical to a certain degree what Anonymous did, because what it essentially did is just like we saw in Paris, you have relatives saying, oh, my son, he was a great boy. It's always, oh, my son was a great boy. They never had any problems. They were wonderful.
Because he's out of the names.
It sounds like, you know, when you hear about these, you know, other cases here in the States, they're wonderful kids. But then, of course, they do these monstrous things. But what they've done is they've, you know, listed out. It's like Ashley Madison against
the
jihadists. Yeah. And what they're doing is they're basically saying, okay, here's the names and address. These are the people. This is what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure somewhere there's moms going, not my son, this is not going to happen, you know.
But
it does shine a light in the darkness. And when you shine that light, the cockroaches scatter, right?
Yeah.
And I it'll be interesting to see how it plays out over time. But I think it's interesting, you know, that, you know, here you have all these, you know, husbands and wives that were concerned about Ashley Madison. But now you have, you know, these young men and women are online doing things that are also being discovered, going through the same thing of being publicly disgraced or being publicly advertised.
Well, it's like when Anonymous has gone after the Ku Klux Klan and listed their members, and there were some U.S. senators on the list, among others, so a lot of rather embarrassed public officials.
But this, remember, too, you got to keep in mind with all this as well. If you're looking at this from a professional standpoint, even when these names are given, even when these things come out, it doesn't mean that they're all legit either.
True.
And because, number one, who's anonymous?
Who knows?
They're anonymous. So is there an agenda? Could other people be placed in there? So you got to remember to take things.
Well,
we just can't grab pitchforks and, you know, and torches and go to the nearest, you know, internet cafe to find somebody who's doing stuff, because there's other games that are afoot.
Realistically, Jeffrey, you're talking about supporting boots on the ground to go in and root out ISIS in Syria or Iraq. Can that be done with an all-volunteer army, or are we talking about having to reinstate the draft to make that happen?
No, I don't think the draft is necessary at all. What we've seen in our all-volunteer army, I mean, trust me, the last thing ISIS wants to do is to face the 1-7 or the 2-5 and the Marine Corps coming in there to address that problem set. They know exactly what happens when that occurs, and it's not good for them. So I think we should keep that on that level. But we're also losing sight of the fact that it's not just incumbent upon the United States to provide those boots. It also would have to come from our allies in the Arab world, be it Egypt, be it Jordan, be it others in that region, or as well as from Europe, to do this in a manner that is sharing the burden. There's no question about that. It has to be done together as a team. It has to be done bringing the worlds of Islam and the Arab world together with the world that is outside of those areas as well. And people have to share the sacrifice, share the burden. I believe there is now a willingness to do that. We just need the leadership to bring it together.
Okay. What are the consequences of not doing that for those who are very understandably concerned about the sacrifice of more American lives to go over there and do that?
Mm-hmm.
What are the consequences if we don't do it?
Yeah. All I can do is say, as somebody who studies this day in and day out, and also as somebody who has lost friends, who has friends that suffer from TBIs and are wounded warriors and have friends who are refugees in these conflicts. I get it. I understand it. I understand that cost. Where I'm coming from on this personally is that the cost to deal with this at a later date will be even more severe.
Sort of like during World War II, there was a very similar debate in America when people didn't want to go after Hitler. It was viewed as a European problem until he started, bombing London. And the next thing you know, we had the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, and that pulled the United States in. But by then, it was a world war.
Well, listen to Hitler's declaration of war. You can listen to it on YouTube, where all he does is lay out a litany of things that President Roosevelt ordered or did to try to push us into war with Germany, because he saw it in our national interests to prevent them from continuing to gain strength and to basically preserve other democratic nations in Europe. But the reality is, politically, the country wasn't ready for that. They were devastated by World War One. This is an isolationist country at this point. You had a large group of German immigrants throughout the country that were very hesitant. We had major rallies. We had brown shirt rallies, pro-Nazi, selling out Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
We had all these things happening.
It's much like now. We've had a rising anti-war sentiment after more than a decade of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the American people are sort of war weary once again.
And understandably. But remember, our adversaries don't look at this as a 2-year, 3-year, let's base it on an appropriation cycle type mentality. They look at this specifically as a multi-generational war. And it's one that it's not a situation where we say they will all be solved. Even in the best case scenario, we can prevent it from being able to impact our national interests directly, as well as the interest of our allies overseas. We can prevent it from metastasizing, hopefully, to other areas. But we're talking about an idea, an approach, a deviation in Islam that goes back for centuries. Yeah. Basically, this is an idea, an ideology that has been around and been built on for centuries. And it will, no matter how much we do, just like neo-Nazism, no matter the Ku Klux Klan, other things, these are ideologies. They will never fully ever be eradicated. We have to accept that. But what we don't have to accept is that these ideologies can basically take over and build the apparatus for modern nation state and are able to wage the sort of horrible wars that we see against civilian populations as well as peaceful populations in their vicinity. We should not be tolerating that.
Is there also a role for someday building hope so that people who are disaffected and joining these causes will perhaps find more positive channels for their future?
But remember what you just said. Your pre-assumption there is that people didn't have hope or that they needed to have something built. Remember the MIT study.
Yeah.
Remember the concrete examples we have with folks that have been arrested in our own country for being related involved with ISIS. These are individuals that have had they're in college. They're going to school. They're living the quote unquote American dream. They're moving. They're having everything possible being made. They're psychologically robust. They are better off financially than average. So when you talk about hope, there's a hope that we talk about in the West in materialistic terms. Mm-hmm. They're obviously achieving it. What they're looking at is hope for something else entirely, which is a world that is completely encased within that rigid ideology that ISIS presents. A dualistic world of light and darkness. And either you are part of this, the notion of tawhid, that all things come and are directly subservient to all, either you're with God or you're without. But they define what without means. They define what with means. And if you don't agree, and if you're a Muslim, you're a non-Muslim, do we know the fate?
Yeah, it's all deeply troubling. Let's end today, Jeffrey, by talking about your class. What are some of the lessons that you're teaching your students in this class as it relates to some of the issues we've just been talking about here today?
Well, I teach a couple different classes. I teach courses that deal with the history and evolution of warfare. I teach courses that deal with kind of the geopolitics of the situations that we're confronting with ISIS and others. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the emergency management course, what we're doing is we're talking about a lot of the concrete disciplines of what we've, as we call them, the disciplines of emergency management. Terrorism is but one of those areas that we look at, terrorism and counterterrorism. But there are many other things that are very important to consider. For example, we study hazards and risk. We study mitigation and preparedness. We discuss disaster education. We talk about the importance of communications. And that's all before we even get to the response area in terms of disaster response, but also the recovery process and then how this happens on the global levels as well in international humanitarian assistance and disaster response. So there's a wide area of coverage. When we talk about things that deal with emergency management, the terrorism, the human element that we have to concern ourselves with, which is terrorism or counterterrorism or, you know, cyber, you know, hacking, bringing down power grids and things along those lines.
Yeah.
That's one element. And there's the whole natural element as well.
Yeah. And we're going to be talking about natural disasters, some other risks that we face right here locally in an upcoming show. It'll be part two of this interview today. But I want to give you the final word. Where can our listeners go to get more information, Jeffrey, about the courses you're teaching at San Diego State if they want to learn more about disaster preparedness or any of these other issues we're talking about?
Yeah. One thing that San Diego State does, it does offer the ability for people to take courses through what we refer to as Open University, where members of the community can go through our College of Extended Studies.
Yeah, and that's open to anybody.
And it's open to anybody, anybody in the community that can come in who wants to sit in on a course and learn more about these subjects. That said, we've also designed a specific course. This is a one-unit class that people can take that's an introduction to humanitarian assistance and disaster response.
It's a weekend class?
It's a weekend class. It's usually taught on a Friday from like 3 to 9 and then like a Saturday from 9 to 4 or something like that. And what we do is we kind of go over these are the basics of the discipline. For those that might be interested in graduate study, we are at our university, we have a course in our online Masters in Public Administration course that deals with emergency management, as well as in our normal public administration curriculum. And we also have one in our Homeland Security graduate program. We have another one in our public health. So there's different disciplines and different areas of expertise. It's such a rich field that there's different people that can bring very fascinating things to bear to this subject.
Listeners, you can go to sdsu.edu and click on the College of Extended Studies to get a lot more information. We have been speaking with Jeffrey McElwain. I want to thank you so much, Jeffrey, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
My pleasure. Thank you.